Hopefully learn something new from. That is our objective, to look at things from a different perspective. Today we have Mike Cross with us. He's the author of Freedom from Conscience, Melanie's Journey, that discusses psychopaths and their relation to politics, society, and personal relationships. Mike is a former Oregonian, now a resident of Stockholm, where he teaches psychology and international finance. We begin the first hour commenting on the Nordic model and the Swedish style of government and economics, and how this have shaped the society and the people. Mike talks about how conformity within a society is an ideal system for the psychopath. Very important and interesting. Stay with us. Welcome to Red Eyes Radio, Mike Cross. It's very good to have you with us. How are things in Stockholm, Mike?
Oh, quite good. Now that it's spring, things are thawing out, and it seems that there's energy returning.
Finally, some life returning. Exactly, that's right. Well, you're obviously an American. You came to Sweden. You told me about 11 years ago. How do you like it so far, Mike?
Well, there's some pluses and minuses. The one real negative thing is the Swedish winters. So coming from Oregon, that was a big shock. Where maybe you get 2 days where there's some snow on the ground, it melts away, and here where, well, at least last year, where it was 6 months of white on the ground, that was a little frustrating.
That's right. Oregon again. We have so many guests from Oregon. People are going to laugh out there probably, but okay, that's good. I've been to Oregon. I like Oregon, so I've been to both. We have a conversation here with two people who have been to both our homes, then, so to speak, so that's great.
Excellent.
Tell us about how you ended up in Sweden, what you're doing there now. Obviously, we're going to get into the topic of your novel, your book about freedom from choice, going into psychopathy. It's a big subject, one we've touched upon before on the program as well, and we want to get your take on this and hear about your research on this. But what are you doing in Sweden currently, Mike?
Well, first of all, it's freedom from conscience. I did a play on the words because everyone thinks of freedom of conscience being like this very high, noble-sounding, highly moral worldview. And we'll go into this in more detail, but I chose freedom from conscience since I'm writing from the perspective of a character who's psychopathic.
Ah, I see.
So, we can explore that. But essentially what I'm doing here is, well, I'm an educator. I teach psychology and international finance to mostly 17 to 20-year-olds. And I'm experienced as an educator in Oregon, graduated from the University of Oregon. That's about the basics.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and so are they all Swedish students, or do you get exchange students as well?
No, they're all Swedish. They're all Swedish.
There you go.
But the program's in English because so many Swedes, young Swedes, have very good proficiency in English, and they want to improve it so that they might study in, like, Britain, the United States, Australia, and so forth.
You know what? I understand that they want to go abroad in many cases. I definitely do. But this is also one of my points of critiques, because we're definitely losing our language up here. Swedish is being turned into almost the second-hand language, if you will, in that sense. All the signs and commercials and everything is starting to become in English. So we're definitely getting ready for the world culture, if you will, Mike.
Well, I always say that the European Union is the first step in making like a United States of Europe. And just like the Roman Empire, which I think many who are forming the EU have the view that this is the new Roman Empire, you need a language that everyone can talk to and talk with. And so English will be the new Latin, I think, within 20 years of most, if not all, of Europe.
I think you're right, and of course, that's not a bad idea. I think if we can all find a level of communication, it's easier to understand each other, easier to avoid mistakes, if you will. So that it's a good thing, obviously, on the surface, if people can keep to it. But we'll see how that develops for sure, Mike. Yeah. What do you make of like teaching psychology though to Swedish students? Did you do the same in America? And is there anything? Is there a difference to you?
There's pluses and minuses. What I notice is it's harder to get any Swedes of any age to really engage in a lively discussion.
Oh yeah.
There seems to be a great deal of, and I think it's an unwritten set of rules in Sweden, that consensus is the ideal, that contention and controversy and those kinds of things should be avoided at all costs. So if I have a classroom, I usually find that it's all classrooms in Sweden are mixed. You have a variety of students, Swedish, as well as people whose parents are from other countries. It's usually the students from other countries, like if they're from Russia or Turkey or Iran or something, who really will start, you can get kind of a debate going. But it's difficult with getting what I would call, I guess, ethnic Swedes to kind of engage in debate. However, I will notice that they are much more learned. They really have a way of being able to write and convey their message, whereas Americans really don't learn that until they get into like the university system itself, and often not until your second and third year of university do you really learn how to do a decent term paper or something like that, because it is kind of in Sweden you're expected to analyze and present yourself in a written form. In America, it's multiple choice and true-false tests primarily.
Ah, I see. Well, I'm personally obviously curious to hear about some of this. I've been concerned about where Sweden is heading for a long time. I've been voicing those concerns maybe a little bit shorter than that, but I've definitely been looking at the culture from a different view. So it's interesting to me to hear this from a person who's also coming from the outside to balance my own point of view a little bit and see if it's biased or see if I'm just doing a mistake here. But as you know, Mike, as well, it's very difficult to see and observe your own culture when you're in it, in a sense. And you have to kind of take yourself outside of it, within it, to be able to understand it. But that goes right against the norm, if you will, of especially Swedish society, who is very, as you say, very about conformity and collectivism in a way. So you have to take yourself outside of that, which is kind of difficult to do in there. But that's interesting to hear. I know that you listened to the commentary, Mike, that I did on the Nordic model, an audio commentary that we have on the website. What can you say about that, though? Is there anything there you would agree with for people who don't know what the Nordic model is? I will definitely link it up so people can read a little bit more about it. There's just so much to say about it. But in short, Mike, anything you want to say about that?
Well, essentially, what came to mind was, I mean, describing the mentality of, I would say, strong conformity in a corporatist society. When I'd heard a lot about Sweden, I knew it was a socialist nation when I moved from Oregon, and Oregon has about one of the most left-leaning state government systems and population of anyone in the United States, with maybe the exception of Massachusetts. The interesting thing, though, is there's a philosophy of Oregon. It's very individualistic. There's been people that have commented and joked. I think George Carlin made a joke that the people on the West Coast are the ones that every time civilization would stretch forward in the manifest destiny of America, the nonconformists went further and further west till the ocean stopped them.
That's right.
So Oregon's kind of an interesting blend of left/progressive politics and culture, but at the same time hyper-individualistic. In the sense that you just kind of want to do your own thing. I mean, you can do your own thing. You can go one day to a hippie convention in the summer in Elmira, Oregon, and the next day go to the Eugene Rodeo in Eugene, right just down the road, and feel totally comfortable doing that and blending in all of these different ideas. So when I saw that Sweden was socialistic and stuff, and you know, I talked to my wife about it. She'd give me some warnings, but I thought, oh, well, it's going to be like Oregon. And then when I came, I'm a fan of old movies, like, you know, example, Metropolis. I think it's a really interesting classic.
Yeah.
And when I first went into the subways in Stockholm in the morning, you know, when I was on my way to work, the first day of work, I was really reminded of the scene in which, if anyone's seen Metropolis, where all the workers are heading down the subway system and getting on the elevators and going down in underground to do their job.
Yeah.
Very mechanized, very A, B, C, D, and this, and no one talking to one another. And I was like, what's going on? And then I got on the subway and no one speaking, not a sound. And it's like, you got the whole thing crammed with people and everyone's pretending not to notice each other. And I was like, well, this is kind of strange. And then I had to, and of course, with a psychology background, I had to start analyzing this. And I found that, I mean, there's a lot of political explanations for it, but really it's sort of a system in which you're kind of not supposed to interfere with each other. And it seems, and many Swedes seem to feel that that gives them a certain liberty to do as they please, whereas where I come from, it's more like this just allows government to do whatever it pleases and no one is connected to one another.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So they just let it happen.
Yeah.
I mean, and everyone kind of looks at life like, okay, I'm going to graduate from gymnasium. I'm going to spend a couple of years maybe in an accelerated program before going to university, or I'm going to go travel a year or two. I'm going to come back to university. I'll do my university program. Maybe, because in Sweden, marriage is an option, maybe get married in my early 30s, and if there's still time, I might decide to have a kid or two. And then you work and work and work, and then, well, up until recently, you expected, well, when I'm 65 or 67, I'm going to retire. Now the prime minister's saying, oh, well, maybe. And, of course, this is floating. Anyone knows anything about politics knows that when a politician says, well, maybe we should let people work till they're 75. Well, that's floating the idea.
Yep.
They absolutely are going to make it law. They're just floating this out to make it sound, well, yeah, I guess if someone really wants to, you know, if you're a teacher or a psychologist or a physician, you can still work when you're 75. And then, you know, it'll become law. And so I just tell young people, hey, you're probably not going to work till 75. You're probably going to work till 85. And I tell them, well, guess what? No one in Sweden's having babies. So, I mean, at least the birth rate is so low that a socialist system cannot survive unless people are having babies. Not 1.5 or 1 point whatever it is. I mean, and you know, yeah. Otherwise people are going to have to either pay huge taxes or they're going to work till they drop.
That's right. I mean, exactly. On the surface of things, there's nothing wrong with certain set of choices. But as you say, you describe it very well there, because it's very, very packaged. It's very, very difficult to climb outside of this little box or bucket, if you will, that has been created for you. And if you do, it's actually in some cases sociologically, it's kind of frowned upon by your peers in a sense. You're not supposed to do that. There's even a concept known as the Jante Law, which is quite interesting to read. It's basically just a – have you heard about that, by the way, Mike?
Oh, yeah, the whole thing about how you behaved in a small village.
Yes, that's right. And basically – well, it's a set of 10 rules. I can link this up as well so people can read them all for themselves. But basically it's don't think you're anything special. Don't try to achieve anything which is outside of the norm. You're same as everybody else. And, of course, that, Mike, is in complete opposition to, if you will, some of the – what has been at least the roots of American philosophy, that it's the individual who can achieve certain things, and it's because of your you know, your own creativity and how intuitive and inventive you are, that is what's going to kind of make you in a way. But here in this society, it's more the collective, as you say, the hive is going to create things together, you know?
Yeah, and the thing is, if we're talking about philosophy of a society, if I were to sum up Oregon, and this would probably be true of Northern California, too. I mean, there's not much of a difference between the cultures there, all the way down to San Francisco. Then it changes, but, you know, the West Coast from San Francisco up. There's sort of a philosophical sense of explore the limits. I would actually say that is the way Oregonians and many people in Washington, Northern California, see life. And that means you just do, if you have time, you're going to experience it. Some take it into hedonism, but most of the time it's, let's just see what there is out there to challenge ourselves with.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I were to look at, I've struggled with this, trying to figure out the philosophy of Sweden, and not to put it down, but it's there.
Oh, no worries about that. You can. Go ahead.
Okay. I would say, if V.F. Skinner were alive today, he would say Sweden is the model.
Exactly. There you go.
Behaviorism. And as anyone who's read Noam Chomsky's discourse on behaviorism is the ideal system for having a conformist society that everyone will do their job and enjoy their job or wherever, whatever place they are in society, they will accept it, do it, and it's stimulus response. You do this, you're rewarded. But then again, if you do get rewarded, you're in Sweden, you're supposed to feel guilty for it.
Exactly. Yep.
And the kids learn that from a very young age. I mean, I can see that in my own family. I mean, when my kids are a little loud and they're doing something unusual, I'm just kind of like, oh well, they're being kids. My wife's more likely to say, well, no, they shouldn't do that. They should, you know. Even when outside in the woods, don't yell so loud, don't talk so loud. And that is a pervasive mindset in Sweden. Try not to get noticed. Try not to stand out. Try to hide. And we can go into this later, but I personally think that is an ideal society for these kinds of political psychopaths to rise to power and actually be able to dominate the society.
Well, there you go, exactly. And this is why this is so interesting, and this is how it ties in with your work, of course, because I don't personally believe, Mike, that this is also a choice of the people. It's very difficult to know exactly what shapes the culture, but I personally believe that it's something that has happened through a long, long period of time. If we look back at the history and the incredible abuse that the people have been subjected to by church and by state, and it was a very long time ago in that sense that we had our few revolutionaries like Nils Dacke and some of these people who actually marched towards Stockholm and protesting the tax, over taxation at the time. This is back in the 1500s, I believe. So that's quite a bit ago. So the mentality of the Swedish people has slowly been molded, and now, of course, it's highly taken advantage of by the power, the politicians and the elite of this country. And what's worrying to me, though, is that most people have now then this unwillingness to recognize that or even the curiosity to question that, because everyone is so absorbed about, as you say, not standing out, that they're not kind of looking outside of their own perimeter in a way.
Well, the one thing I like to expose young people to is the idea that there's no such thing as something that happens by accident. And the thing is that I just got done I made a YouTube video about it too, but I was exploring the idea of, for instance, where did today's morality come from? And so most people just figure, okay, well, it's just evolved. It's just things that have happened since the 50s, 60s, 70s, and it's just been by accident. People have just kind of said this is the right way. And I produced a YouTube video just titled, you know, sexual revolution and alternative lifestyles in the future, and where I kind of explore the idea that you have to understand it fully. You have to understand the individual Wilhelm Reich,
mm-hmm. Yeah,
and his idea that you could overthrow the established order if you were to do a reverse Freud. You release everyone's inhibitions so that family doesn't mean as much and so forth, and everyone's kind of doing their own thing, and eventually people would overthrow the traditions of the church and the state, and you wouldn't really need a revolution to establish a socialist society. And so the thing is that the left during, of course, the 1960s, when they found that they were no longer able to really use the power of protest and so forth to crumble the established order, they basically turned it over to kind of a almost a you know, the what do they call it, the political is personal.
Mm-hmm.
And then you tried to not so much have your mini Russian Revolution, you instead fostered the notions of if it feels good to do it, ignore the past, just live for yourself. This opened up, you know, experiment sexually and in alternative lifestyles and all these things. And, of course, with the advent of the birth control pill, which came along right at the same time, this actually did break down a lot of those traditional foundations that people could at least say, okay, well, you know, I can explore around the society, but I can hang on to my religion, or I can hang on to the idea of family is central. Well, that broke that away to where people could just kind of float around, and then it just takes people who are very skilled at social control and behaviorism to then fit them back into a new mold.
Yeah, exactly. And this is, you know, something I've been struggling with as well, because, I mean, partially what you describe is something that's that has happened in Sweden. You maybe think on the surface then that there, if there's an introvertedness of like this very behavioralistic type of society, that's tend to maybe go towards the conservative, and maybe that's a little bit more what has happened in some Asian countries, Japan and so forth. You know, where they also kind of, there's some echoes of Swedish society in the Asian cultures, I think. But in this sense, Sweden is also very, at the same time, then very, very progressive and left in that sense, and actually very liberal when it comes to adopting, you know, new ideas and new disciplines, which is kind of an oxymoron, isn't it, at the same time?
Well, it may be that when people do try to break through the and be creative, that then that unleashes an energy of creativity, that someone can suddenly, you know, go in there and make something new. But that still is not something that is, it doesn't float out like osmosis. It doesn't really involve a huge percentage of the population. Those that do break the mold are able to do a lot of neat things. But most of the time, it just seems to me that the ideal that's presented, like if you were living in America, a lot of times there's a real stress on, hey, you can create your own job, you can open up a business, you can do all these fantastic things, the world is wide open. In Sweden, it's sort of like the ideal is, if they talk of, you know, there's no real talk in much of the culture of true entrepreneurship.
No.
It's a sense that your goal in life, if you're aiming towards the future, is to work for the government or a very large corporation.
Yeah, monopoly, work for the big ones, and that's a comfort zone in that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like I said, I mean, the ideal is you'll work those years, you'll have your 1.5 kids, maybe optionally, and then you'll retire and live in a little apartment for the remainder of your days.
That's right.
It's
very worrying to me and to see how this has happened, and I, you know, personally, Mike, have obviously through a gradual wake up process begun to realizing what is going on around me. You know, my basic drive has been to understand why things are the way they are. You know, well, why are things corrupt? Why can't I do what I want to do? Why is it other people telling me what to do? And obviously then try to put this society in comparison to others and so forth. But what I personally have found at this point is that this society is actually one of the worst ones. I'm not saying that there's not good things about it. There is a safety net. It's very safe. It's very padded. Every corner is padded. It's taken care of. But that's not always the best thing. You need to be challenged sometimes. You need some upheaval in your life to grow, both on a personal and psychological level as well, Mike. Wouldn't you agree?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if everything's done for you, it turns into, I don't know how many people have watched the old Star Treks, where they went to this one planet and everyone is very nice. All these people are dressed up like in Western clothes and they greet each other, hello brother, hello sister, and very, very, very conformist. And then there's like at night, there's a 30-minute time that they can let their repression go.
Isn't this the one that's called The Archons, by the way? This episode?
It might be. I think it is.
Anyway, I love Star Trek. Go ahead, Mike.
Yeah, but I mean, yeah, if you're going to use analogies, we could talk about the Borg. But
well, exactly. Now you're talking about. Well, Beyond Borg? Uh-oh. No, I'll go ahead.
But the idea is that the human psyche, and I could bring up some stuff about Freud, but the human psyche is that we have these desires and urges, and we really do want to express ourselves. And if that's repressed too much, it'll come out in other areas. Now, if someone wants to visit Sweden for a week, they can walk. They'll see, you know, nice, tidy roads, no litter, people standing politely waiting for their train or bus in lines, which is kind of interesting. They won't talk to one another. But go, and spend time downtown in Gothenburg or Stockholm on a Friday or Saturday night.
Oh, yeah. Now you're getting to it. The schizophrenic nature of society here. Go ahead, Mike.
Oh, I mean, I've heard that there are actually bars in, the Netherlands and stuff that actually ban Swedes. Because drinking is kind of considered the time to let yourself go. And you'll see people, in America, public drunkenness you can be arrested for. But, you'll see people just standing. I mean, people as young as 14 just standing, waiting for the train. All of a sudden they hurl. Right there.
Yeah, yeah.
And you're just like, wow, what is it? And then on weekdays, they go sit in their cubicle or whatever. And to me, it's maybe if there was a little bit more openness and doing your own thing, maybe people would be just kind of like, well, maybe I don't really want to socialize when, get on a boat and go to Finland and party it up and meet people that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, to me, it's amazing that also how this lifestyle, in a sense, have been encouraged, the schizophrenia here in that sense. This is encouraged at a time to let everything out, all the potential, anger that has been ramped up during the week. Now you can just kind of, open the steam valve in a way and let all of this out during the weekend. It's as a psychologist, Dan, from a psychological point of view, how healthy is that, do you think, in terms of schizophrenia here,
Well, in my opinion, this is one thing that maybe people should watch out for, and that is the idea that many of the young people in Sweden today are learning English so that they can go to school in other countries. By and large, most of those people who go to the United States, for instance, will wind up wanting to stay there. Almost everyone I know who's, when I first started teaching here, some of these people are now in their early 30s. They wind up going to America. Most of the time they marry an American, and they don't come back. They stay wherever they have gone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My wife has a really good friend who, she went to school with, and she married someone from Oregon, this woman is the ultimate in libertarian now. I mean, she broke totally away from the Swedish mold. She has, 9 kids. She homeschools. She lives out in the country, and she's like a Ron Paul supporter.
Well, good for her. She homeschools as well. One thing that's been banned in Sweden, as you might know, Mike.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's the two countries that ban homeschooling, Germany and Sweden.
Yeah. Amazing.
And Germany's laws date back to the 1930s.
Yeah, there you go. It says quite a bit, doesn't it? It's, wake up, Sweden, for Christ's sake. Where are you heading? I mean, this is, it's embarrassing. But I can talk about this forever. I have so many points of criticism. And again, this is not to say that you know, it's just, you know, best somewhere else either. This, I'm just trying to, you know, in all fairness, just look at the points of criticism that I have about this culture and this country, or even the Scandinavian countries in many cases, because it's not that much different if you go to Denmark or to Norway. But if we just for a moment then begin to shift over and look at this from point of view of your work again more, how does the psychopath fit into all of this? Do we have a psychopathic political elite in Sweden that you've been able to see, Mike?
Without naming names, I could see it. I don't want to name names. I don't want to say, oh, yeah, I heard from so-and-so, mm-hmm. who worked for so-and-so, that, you know, that sort of thing. It's very difficult. But I think, you know, if you look at the research, around 3% of the male population and about 1% of the female population, and it's cross-cultural. It doesn't matter really what race, ethnicity, or whatever, is psychopathic. And the thing is that if we compare, I mean, well, first of all, I'd like to go into the idea of why psychopaths exist in the first place, but first let me answer your question. Mm. In America, the psychopath, and again, I'm kind of getting ahead because I want to say what they are and everything.
Right, right.
But the psychopath usually has to be very outgoing and TV-friendly to get elected nowadays if they're going for public office. Because in America, the political party is not that important. What's important is how you can rally the troops around you and how you can get yourself elected and being able to give that really good soundbite. Because, see, we don't deal with politics anymore. We deal with politicians.
That's right. It's not about what is being said. It's about how it's being said.
Oh yeah, yeah. And I try to remind people that the word leadership and manipulation mean the same thing.
Yeah.
Getting people to do something different. But you learn how to use words. If you go into, like, the political psychologist, Frank Luntz, I mean, that's his whole profession, is finding out what word you can use that still says the truth, but gives a positive impression in someone's mind.
I'll stop you right there. I'm glad you brought up Frank Luntz. Too many people don't seem to be aware of him, which is kind of a worry, you know, aspect in itself. But he wrote that book, of course, Words That Work, I think it was called.
Mm-hmm.
What more can you say about his work? He's been doing focus groups for forever, and he's a highly paid consultant, I think, when it comes to developing, you know, political campaigns. Isn't that right?
Yeah, he worked with, I think, Gingrich. He worked with Berlusconi. I think Rudolph Giuliani and a few other conservative politicians. What it is this. If I say a word, if I were to use the word, let's rape the land, well, people go, what are you talking about? That's horrible. You know, because it conjures up that abstract word, rape. Now, if I say instead, let's utilize the resources, well, I may be saying the same thing if I own a mine and I'm saying, let's go out there and get that whatever rock is
mm-hmm.
under the ground.
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to sound like an environmentalist or anything, but I am saying that if I use those words, they mean the same thing ultimately, but you don't want to say rape the land. It's just not going to come over very good.
Yeah.
And what Frank Luntz does is he does the focus group, but then he monitors people's responses. They're sitting there with a little machine, and they're rating how they feel during a speech. And that's very important because nowadays politics, and many of our politicians don't write their own speeches. They're created in the back room rating feelings. And, I mean, you can see Obama, he reads from a teleprompter. I mean, he might as well just let everyone download his speech because he's just reading it. He's not saying anything offhand by himself.
That's right.
But these are carefully orchestrated words they use. Now, I'll point this out. I talked to my dad. My dad's turning 90 this year. And I knew that he had voted for Obama. So I said, well, how do you feel about the Libyan war? And he was going, oh, well, Obama didn't do that. And I'm like, what? What do you mean? And he said, no, NATO made him do it. And I go, well, wait a minute. Where does that come from? He watches the news. He, you know, he doesn't use the internet or anything.
Mm.
And the way Obama did word it to the American public was sort of a, well, NATO has kind of begged us to go and do this. When, if you read about how it was pretty much the French and the Americans, and to a certain degree the British kind of going along, saying, let's go get Gaddafi. And but yet you can word it in such a way that it deflects all blame. You use just the right words, and in people's minds, they're hearing, ah, yeah, that's right. So, I mean, you don't have to be Bill Clinton saying, I did not have sex with that woman, which... Of course, in his mind, he was telling the truth because he was actually saying, according to British common law, that since he had not had actual intercourse with Monica Lewinsky, that he did not have sexual relations with that woman. You know,
oh my God. Yeah.
According to the definition, he did not do it. But now, I think most people would think, well, wait a minute. Yeah, you did.
Yeah, of course, of course. It's interesting, too, because that maybe is a sign, if you will, then of how the psychopath operates, because there's no, how should I put this? There's no like living interpretation of things. It's like it's a dead. They're within the realm of a dead system. There's no emotion there in that sense. So they're just trying to find the, as you say, the legal definition of something and follow. As long as I follow that line, I'm okay. I'm safe in a sense.
Yeah, I mean, in that sense, or you do have some emotion. I mean, if you look at the kind of emotion that Hillary Clinton displayed when she was laughing and joking about killing Gaddafi.
Oh, God, yeah.
I mean, there's some pretty disturbing emotion in that interview. But, there's a sense that it's almost like a sense that when a five-year-old, and I can go back to why I think psychopathy is very similar to a young child, when a five-year-old can actually try to find the right words to say something and get away with it. Like, mm-hmm. You know, the cookie, he stole the cookies, but he can kind of, his mom says, were you in the cookie jar? No, but then he's not saying that he got his three-year-old sister to hand him a cookie from the cookie jar, you know, and that sort of thing. And that's what politics is today.
That's right.
If you want to explore that a second, I was just going to say that a little bit about why I think that psychopathy is very similar to kind of an arrested development.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. If you go into any of the theories like Bandura's social learning model and stuff, the idea is as we grow up, we see what we're supposed to do and what's right and what's wrong. And since humans are sort of designed where we try to fit in, I mean, it's part of our nature. If we didn't fit in, we'd all be just kind of living by ourselves off in the woods, and we wouldn't reproduce, and we'd just die off. We need to kind of come together. So most children, 97% of males and 99% of females, learn by the age of 8 what the rules are. They kind of write it into their minds. But there is a small number that don't really write those rules in. And that's who we could say are the psychopaths. They have that sort of, I mean, I don't want to make young children sound bad. I've got 8 children of my own, love kids very much. But a small child can have sympathy, but they have a very hard time with empathy.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
If you tell a 4-year-old, mommy's sad because you didn't clean your mess up, they can sort of understand that. Okay, they see mommy sad. If you tell a 4-year-old before mom gets home, hey, can you clean your stuff up so mom will be happy? They don't process that because that requires them to actually put themselves into mom and how she would feel if she comes in and finds the mess on the table cleaned up.
Hmm.
Now, most kids by the age of 8 develop this sense of empathy, this sense of connection, and however you want to feel about guilt. It does motivate a lot of people. Well, I better do this because if I don't, then I'm going to feel bad because I broke the rules. I did something wrong. Most people feel that way if they do something wrong. They look at maybe they see someone walking down the street and that person sticks their hands in their pocket and they're fumbling around for their comb or something. And out of their pocket falls a 500 kroner, or in America, $100 bill, let's say, or something.
Yeah.
It falls on the ground. almost everyone thinks, oh, that'd be kind of nice, just go pick that up. You know, why don't I go, I mean, this is my lucky day, I've got some money. They didn't notice, they're walking off. But almost everyone will actually, even in Sweden, will go grab the money and say, sir, ma'am, you dropped this.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
Yes. The psychopath, on the other hand, is like that four-year-old who, when their brother or sister leaves their candy on the table and goes in the other, you know, goes to the bathroom or something, they start stealing it. Kind of like, oh, it's on the table. Might as well take it. The psychopath still has that mentality. Now, I don't want to say the psychopath's like some cuddly four-year-old, but in the sense when it comes to their development and how they see the world, it is a very egocentric way. And when they see the person drop the 500 kroner or $100 bill on the ground, they're waiting until they're out of sight, and then they run over and grab it, put it in their pocket, and they have just won. They don't have any guilt whatsoever. They may in their mind go, well, if they were dumb enough to not have it in their wallet, then they deserve to lose it.
Well, that's an interesting point then, because we've addressed this before as well on the program. The question if psychopaths actually have a form of a brain damage. The Scientific American did an article on this a while back. We linked it up on the website as well. It seems to point this out, that there's something kind of, well, missing, or as you say, in that sense, that there's a certain development stage of the brain that doesn't happen. And of course, you're right, Mike. It doesn't mean that, you know, kids are evil in a certain, you know, sense at a stage in their life. It just means that the development hasn't just actually physically even happened in the brain yet, and the personality isn't, you know, completely shaped or created even yet, in a sense. So that's just the way things are. But why don't these people then move along, if you will? Why does this part not develop in the brain? Is that a disorder? How should we look at this?
Well, first of all, I will have to say this. There was an individual who did a study on, and I think his last name was Fallon, and he did a study on serial killers and stuff, because he was told by, I think it was his grandmother or great aunt or something, guess what? We have a lot of killers in our family. And he was like a psychologist. He's going, what? And at the same time, he's studying DNA and brain patterns of people who kill. Hmm. And what he did was, just out of curiosity, he thought, okay, let me see here. I'm going to take a blood sample and look at my brain. So, you know, because he found what he called the warrior gene, which seems to be associated with psychopathology. And so the guy that goes out there and he's banging heads back in the 1500s, you know, he's the big warrior who nothing scared him and he wins. Mm. And sure enough, this psychologist found that he had the gene. And then he looked at his brain under a functional MRI. And sure enough, he had the brain of a psychopath and also the same brain as serial killers, for the most part. And then he's like totally freaked out. He went to his family and said, he asked his family, hey, you know, I did this thing here, and it says I'm like a psychopathic, you know, I have the personality of a psychopath. And his two grown kids and his wife are going, yeah, we've known that a long time. And, you know, here's the first person that, you know, when he was asked about that, he said that, I was raised in a very warm and nurturing environment, and I was taught that helping others was the right thing to do and doing good for people and so forth. So I think that actually, no matter what our brain injury is or our brain makeup, mm-hmm. we can still wind up doing the right thing. I don't believe someone's just born to be a killer or
right.
born to be a bank
robber. Right. It's not all in the genes. It's not a physical thing per se. This is something right. deeper. Go ahead, Mike.
But now here I want to throw this analogy at. There's a disorder known as Asperger's, and it can be severe or it can be very mild. And I'm going to focus more on the mild Asperger, which most people might think is similar to the class nerd that was just totally into math. And if you asked him about math, he would be like, oh, let me tell you this math joke. It's really funny. You know, and stuff, and you're like, yeah, right. But often the Asperger person has a very hard, their brain is set up to where emotional clues kind of get mixed up in the brain. And they know at a very young age, are often picked on, just as psychopaths are often picked on. In fact, in the character I create for my book, she has a history of abandonment by her father, she's picked on in school, and that's kind of lead you into this kind of wanton revenge on society. Now, let's say you have a 6-year-old, let's take it up to 8. You got an 8-year-old Asperger, and you got an 8-year-old psychopath. Now, you don't diagnose psychopaths at 8 years old. It's not considered ethical, even though psychologists have said, you can see the patterns very early on. You just don't want to tell someone your child's a psychopath, unless they're like a royal family or something, or a corporate leader who's probably going, oh, thank you. Wow, right here. Right. So I've got a natural-born leader, in my house. I think that's true to a certain degree.
Oh, you're right.
Yep. See how many women, send letters to serial killers saying, I want to have your baby and stuff. How many women have sent letters to the guy in Norway that shot all those young people?
Have you followed that?
A little bit. I mean, he's tried to get himself diagnosed as a psychopath because then, of course, it's like, oops, he's psychologically damaged, and not totally responsible for what he did.
Right.
But I followed the idea, too, that he gets letters. They're not letting him see the letters, I don't think, but he's getting all these letters from women around the world saying, I want to be, will you marry me? I want to have your baby and stuff like that. And you're going, whoa.
What is that? Why is this happening?
Well, let me finish the Asperger.
Yeah, sure. Go ahead. Sorry about that. Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. With the 2 8-year-olds, let's say the neighbor girl comes over. And she's crying her head off. She's like, oh, my gosh, my kitty died. My kitty got run over by a car. The Asperger kid, being very logical, being very cognitive, is going to say, oh, I guess now you have to buy another kitty. Well, of course, you know how that goes over. The little girl screams like, monster, and then runs off because he just shows no emotion. Because he has the emotion, he just can't show it very well. It would be difficult. It'd be like if I asked the average person, can you do a handstand? You know how it's done, but most people can't do it. And this is what emotions are to an Asperger, mental gymnastics. The psychopath probably says the same thing. Well, why don't you go get another kitty? And the same reaction. Girl screams, cries out. But the one thing the psychopath has an ability to do, even though he or she feels no emotion, very limited emotion, no one's totally without emotion, but limited emotion, is they see what they've just done. And they're going, oh, well, I really kind of have a crush on that little girl. And now she's mad at me. So what the psychopath does is they start taking inventory as they grow up. They start seeing how people react. They go to a funeral of their uncle, and they're kind of like, oh, I wish I didn't have to be here. I could much rather be home watching TV, but, parents said I have to come to this funeral. But then they watch around, and maybe they're just sitting there like, not really paying attention. And the mother's saying, what's with you? You're like, why aren't you showing any emotion? And it's like, oh, I'm sorry. And then he starts looking around like, okay, well, some people are crying here. Some people are. So he learns. He or she learns early on. Okay, well, maybe when someone dies, I should act like I'm crying. I should bow my head. And, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're like an actor or actress that's taking in the script. They're learning more and more. And then, let's say at 16 years of age, same thing happens. Asperger kid, he's out in the yard, and suddenly the neighbor girl comes over. She's 16, and she's like, my cat just died, and she's crying. And he's kind of like, oh, well, okay, are you going to go buy a new cat? just like he did when he was 8 years old.
Mm-hmm. She's
like, what a jerk. And then she runs off. The psychopathic kid who's now been studying human nature, very intently, and how to get certain ways and how not to run afoul of people and so forth, he looks at the situation, thinks, the neighbor girl really has filled out in the last couple of years. She's pretty hot. She comes in. She's like, oh, my cat died. He said, come here. Let me hold you. I mean, that must really hurt. And, it's an act. He doesn't really feel anything.
Right.
He's kind of like, while he's holding her and patting her back, he's thinking, okay, now maybe I should ask her out Saturday morning to go look at cats, and maybe one thing will lead to another. And that is how they see life.
Interesting. Yeah,
so the poor Asperger person who actually has a situation where they're not processing, they feel emotion, but they can't express it very well. The psychopath feels limited emotion, but they can express a great act very well.
I want to let you finish your point, but this is just a very interesting, in one sense, it's a disability, but it's also, in a sense, actually an advantage, because they're not, if you will, then tainted by emotion. At a time when some people are all absorbed, we know what happens when you go into an emotional state, basically. You don't process your surrounding, your reality in the same way, you know? So in a sense, we are, to a certain extent, manipulated by our emotion, and this is harkens back to what you mentioned earlier about what some people even call emotioneering, you know, by using the right words, etc. It's all about how you work with the emotional programming to your advantage in one sense, but these people are not tainted, if you will, then by this, which means that in certain cases they have an upper hand, in a sense. Is that correct?
Exactly, and that's why, for instance, I named the book Freedom from Conscience, because the reader, and hopefully, I mean, the sequel's actually been approved for publishing, hopefully all six of the rough drafts will turn into books, and eventually it follows this girl who becomes a serial killer, but eventually winds up on the top of politics. And the idea is because she's not overwhelmed and grieved by emotions and guilt and stuff, she is able to succeed. But here's the irony, though. Readers have told me. They say, you know, I read this book and it really disturbs me because I'm kind of falling in love with your character. And I'm saying, well, she's a psychopath and she is killing people. And they're going, yeah, but it's done in such a way that it's really cool. It's fun.
Gosh.
And you're like going, okay. And I was a little worried at first when I first did some focus groups before submitting my book. I was like, maybe I shouldn't turn this in. I mean, maybe, you know.
You're going to be responsible for people spiraling into mass murder era.
yeah. But the thing was, I did capture, I'm not bragging, but I sense I did actually capture the essence of a psychopath, because the first person narrative, so all of a sudden I draw people in, they're thinking, wow, I really feel sorry for her. She was picked on. She had this terrible childhood. People have abused her. They don't understand her. Well, of course, she should go get bad people. And I mean, I even had one girl that read and said, you know, I am heterosexual completely, but you know what? If I met her, I would date her. And I'm thinking, okay, you know, I don't know how I did this, but I guess I researched enough about it that I could do it.
Wow,
but
you're coaxing them out in a sense, aren't you?
They're the ones sending letters to the guy in Norway.
Yeah.
So the thing is this. The interesting thing is this. From evolution, the theories that are involved in evolutionary psychology say that all traits have an advantage. And trying to figure out where the heck, because some people that have written about psychopaths just say they're reptilians, they're evil, they're bad, and you know you're thinking it's like Hollywood image of someone just, you know, like not Reinfeld but Renfield from Dracula, you know, like, you know, crawling through the attic and eating bugs and, you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
But in reality, actually, Dracula is the psychopath. But, you know, people's image of the psychopath is the Renfield character. But let's just say back in the old days when people were living in small villages around each other, and pretty much they were probably fairly cooperative, you know, as long as you didn't step on me, I don't step on you. Then as villages grew, at least this is my theory, and I've read this in evolutionary psychology, is that there may have been individuals who were psychopaths. And they looked over at what the other village had. And they knew that they could persuade people. So they were the ones who could rally their friends and the people in the village and say, these people have to be taken over. We need to go raid their village. And so these psychopathic tribal leaders, they raid the village next to them. And they conquer the people. You know, they kill the men and haul the women back, you know, and that sort of thing, and take all the crops and everything. Well, now here's maybe the reason why psychopaths and what I would call normals are able to coexist in this kind of weird symbiotic relationship. But it's not a healthy relationship, it's symbiotic. Those people that were the psychopaths became the leaders, and of course they wound up with mates. You know, leaders wind up with more opportunities to have children. But the followers who were not really psychopaths, they were like secondary psychopaths, like the, oh, what is his name, in Poland, he came up with the notion of political ponderology.
Oh, yeah, I know who you mean, but the name escapes me as well now.
Yeah, L something, it's really long, Polish name, where he says that a society can become psychopathic, or at least secondary psychopaths. Well, the thing is, in the past, if you followed your Genghis Khans or other leaders, the masses, even though they were controlled, they still benefited as long as they were winning. They got the they got some of the crumbs left over after the leadership class, you know, took the prettiest women as theirs, the best land and the best crops. Then they could then tell the other classes, look what I've done for you. Look where we're at now because you made me your leader. And I think a lot of our royal family started out like that. No proof, but you know, someone that wound up becoming someone who could take something of someone else's.
Yeah, you're right, I think.
And yeah, and then just tell the people that they should be so grateful for their great leadership. Even though really, I mean, it's like having Charles Manson in charge of your society.
Yeah, that's right. And in certain cases then, when there is lack in on, you know, abundance on the planet, basically in that sense, we don't know the technical know-how to work with everything to our advantage. This might seem as a beneficial aspect to the rest of the community who are actually, in that sense, getting something out of this by actually positioning a psychopath in the power position, and they have the guts and they lack the emotional framework to actually, you know, they're not hindered by that. They can step over corpses to get what they want, basically, for the
community.
Absolutely.
Again, they have that freedom from conscience.
Right.
They're not going to feel bad. If someone comes in and says, there's a great scene in the movie Primary Colors. I don't know if you've seen that. It was like a John Travolta movie where he plays a character that's based on Bill Clinton. And this woman comes in, she's done some research on the other politician, and she's dug up some real nasty dirt that will ruin this man and his family's life if it gets out. And she puts it on the table, and she looks at Travolta and the woman playing Hillary, and she's going, you know what, I know that because we worked together in the 60s and we had all these ideals that you're not going to do, you won't release this. I know that. I have faith in you that you will not release that. And then there's a scene where the woman, playing Hillary, shakes her head and goes, no, you're right. We were not going to release this. We can't afford to have this connected to our name, so we need to go find some contacts in the media that are not really connected to us that we can leak this through and make sure it gets out to the public. And the thing is that it's almost as if we expect this now, our politicians. We admire it. We don't admire the politician who gave food to the poor. We admire the politician who won a war.
But exactly. But see, now you're into it. Now we're into the deep crevices of so-called ordinary people psychology, which is disturbing in itself because people are attracted to violence and the gore. They like powerful figures and so forth. And this, Mike, I want to stop us right here because I want to carry on and talk about this in the next segment. It would be a good to take a little break here.
Okay.
And this, by the way, I want to mention as well, Andrew Lobachevsky is his name, ponerology.com, if people want to look more at that. It's an interesting website there for you. But before we take a little break, though, Mike, much more to discuss, as I mentioned, in the next segment here. But Freedom from Conscience, Melanie's Journey. It's available on Amazon.com. Probably other bookstores out there as well, but you don't have your own personal website at this stage, Mike, do you?
Oh, unfortunately not. I've had to not prioritize that just now.
All right. When you do, do you have a URL already, or will that come out later too?
That will come out later.
All right. Excellent. Well, heads up on that, then we can always link that up in hindsight as well in case you want to find more from Mike. He has a couple of YouTube videos out there as well, and there are some other sources that will lead you to his work that we're going to link up, of course. But stay with us then, Mike. We'll carry on in the next segment. Very interesting discussion we're having here.
What's wrong?
Nothing, nothing really. I just feel that I need something stronger.
If you have a problem, don't hesitate to ask for assistance.
Yes, thank you. I'll be all right.
Call 348-FUNKY. What's wrong?
Never mind.
Never mind. What is that idea? Are you now? Or have you ever been? Move slowly.
In the second hour, available in our member section, we'll begin to discuss why the individual is turned on by the psychopath in films, in politics, in personal relationships, and in real life. More and more we see this fascination within society, the identification with the dark side of ourselves. Mike incorporates Jungian themes to explain why. Entertainment, as the modern-day shaman, is also becoming saturated with psychopathic leading characters. Mike explains why he thinks this is both a conscious conspiracy and an unconscious desire. Then we'll discuss the political psychopath's paranoia, therefore passing laws to keep themselves protected. We talk about the template of conformity within humanity creating the psychopath's utopia. This brings us deeper into the exploration of the Nordic model of politics and society, which fosters a crab mentality and dire consequences for the people. In the psychopath's utopia, one is ousted for being different or striving for more. To listen to this second hour or any of our previous programs going back to our start in 2006, simply go to our website, redeyescreations.com. Log in if you're a member to stream or download. Click subscribe if you want to get full access to our members area. Before we proceed, I want to let you know that our next guest on Red Eyes Radio is Marty Leeds, talking about Pi, the great work. After that, we have Sterling Allen, Louise Turi, Kristi Johansson, Matt Stein, Stefan Molyneux, Desiree and JJ Hertek, William Davis, Mark Weber, Mary Sean Young, Court Lindahl, Tom Bourne, Jay Widener, Dean Clifford, and Jordan Maxwell, to name a few. But stay with us now as we continue to discuss the template of conformity and the psychopath's utopia with Mike Cross after the break.